Well, hello, everyone, and happy Sunday. I'm not usually one to take naps. Anybody who knows me well knows that, but Ron is watching the Masters, or was watching the Masters, and I took Jamie for a really long walk, and when I came back and settled in my chair with the Masters on, I fell asleep. So I just woke up a few minutes ago, so I'm a little groggy. So I know some people find golf super exciting, but you know, it was a good lullaby for me after a very long walk. I always play a song anyway, but today I kind of need the song to get my juices flowing a little bit. So I'm going to play a song that I have used in the past to motivate me prior to meditation. Really, when I was learning to meditate, I haven't used the song in a long time, but when I was learning to meditate, the name of this song is Wait on the Lord, and it's sung by Ricky Byers Beckwith. Nice. All right, so we are here for the guiding light. And that's when I read from the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi. And I remember last week we were kind of in the middle of a conversation. And I remember part of the conversation was something that I wasn't concerned about. That was the seven stages of something I've already forgotten. Seven stages of knowledge. The seven stages of knowledge. And I had told you all that I wasn't concerned with these seven stages of knowledge. I'm not concerned with intellectual teaching anymore. I once was. You know, of course, everybody I think is at some point. And then at some point it really does just all feel kind of heady. And it feels like believing. And therefore, it really feels in the way of realization rather than helpful to realization. So I'm continuing to read from the same conversation. This is in the section called Attainment on page 35. I'm continuing to read, but I'm not shy about saying, you know, I don't really care about this. Nor do I really feel that Ramana Maharshi actually cares about it either, to be honest. I just feel that he's answering the questions to whatever degree, you know, he is. But I don't feel like this is the heart and soul of his teaching. Yet we were able to get something really useful out of last week. Last week when he talked about the fact that once the ego dies, there is no person, no one driving the body. There is no one that desires something particular for the body and therefore drives the body in a certain way. You know, that came out of this and that was useful. So we'll look and see if there's anything useful today. And if not, we'll move through it pretty quickly. I'm starting with number 6. And this is the question. As some sacred texts say that the supreme state is that in which the sense organs and the mind are completely destroyed, how can that state be compatible with the experience of the body and the senses? Let me just read that question again. As some sacred texts say that the supreme state is that in which the sense organs and the mind are completely destroyed, how can that state be compatible with the experience of the body and the senses? And this is Ramana Maharshi's answer. If that were so, there would not be any difference between that state and the state of deep sleep. Further, how can it be said to be the natural state when it exists at one time and not at another? This happens, as stated before, to some persons according to their karma, for some time or till death. It cannot properly be regarded as the final state. If it could, it would mean that all great souls and the Lord, who were the authors of the Vedantic works and the Vedas, were unenlightened persons. If the supreme state is that in which neither the senses nor the mind exists, and not the state in which they exist, how can it be the perfect state? As karma alone is responsible for the activity or inactivity of the sages, great souls have declared the state of Saha Nirvikalpa, or something like that. But in parentheses it says, the natural state without concepts, alone, to be the ultimate state. So again, Ramana Maharshi is saying here that the natural state without concepts alone is the natural state. And any other phenomenon or experience that may sometimes accompany enlightenment is not enlightenment itself. That if the enlightenment itself is the state of no concepts. And, you know, I can't comment on this too awful much, obviously. I don't have the clarity or the direct experience to really do so. The only thing that it really brings to my mind, well, it's interesting because this month the movie group is watching a movie called Faith Like Potatoes. And Faith Like Potatoes is supposed to be a true story, and I have no reason to doubt that it is. I mean, there's just no reason to doubt it. And if you haven't seen the movie yet, I mean, this is a, I don't know if I should say spoiler alert. It's a slight spoiler alert. So if you want to turn down your sound for about 60 seconds. In the movie, the man Angus, who is the central character in the movie, he raises someone from the dead. And I won't say any more so that I don't spoil anything else. And remember, this is supposed to be a true story. I remember when I was more in course group circles, you know, Awakening Together, of course, you know, we all just follow our hearts. So some people study the course, some don't. But I remember when I was more in circles where everybody studied the course. I remember every now and then somebody would show up saying, if you can't heal the sick and raise the dead, you're not enlightened. Every now and then somebody would say this. Well, what Ramana Maharshi is saying, and what I have really come to through my own contemplation, is that there are different special talents, or there are different experiences that occur. But those experiences or those talents are not directly related to enlightenment. I think that you will probably see when you watch Faith Like Potatoes that when he raises this person from the dead, he's not enlightened. So obviously, raising someone from the dead or healing someone of an illness can occur without enlightenment being present. And enlightenment can be present without these special talents being present. NTI is very clear with us in the book of Luke that any expectations that we have about enlightenment are purely imagination. And it asks us to let go of those expectations. And that is one thing that I have done. It took me many years because just like everyone else, I thought I knew what enlightenment would look like too. And I expected enlightenment to have a consistent look. But I couldn't find that consistent look. And in fact, if you take two of my favorite teachers, Ramana Maharshi and Nisargadatta Maharaj, the only thing consistent about these two teachers is their clarity. Everything else about them is different. Ramana Maharshi was, he fit the mold more for my ideas of enlightenment than Nisargadatta Maharaj. Because Ramana Maharshi was selfless and, very caring about people. You know, there's all kinds of stories about how, he was soft. There's all kinds of stories about how he wouldn't eat until everyone else had been served food first. And when people would travel long distances to come and see them, the first thing he'd ask is, have you eaten? And if not, he'd send them off to eat before they came back to talk to him. And he was very devotional and, you know, really connected to the animals in a St. Francis kind of way. And, you know, I would say that he kind of fits the Regina mold for enlightenment. Nisargadatta, not so much. He shouts. He appears very angry. He throws people out of his loft apartment, you know, because they ask the wrong questions. And yet, I don't doubt his enlightenment. His clarity is too perfect. So the idea that enlightenment is supposed to look a certain way, or the idea that there are certain talents, special talents, that's supposed to come with enlightenment, I think that's really just something we need to drop. And if we don't drop it, I think it's going to be an obstacle, because we'll run across teachers that don't fit our mold. You know, imagine that you're a young person. You know, 18, 19, seeker, you're already a seeker, and you make it to India with your backpack, and you go to visit Nisargadatta Maharaj, and you ask some question that you've been dying to ask a guru, and he starts shouting at you and kicks you out of his loft. You know? It could be quite the stumbling block unless we realize that the mind has no idea what enlightenment is. In fact, enlightenment, as Ramana Maharshi describes it, is the natural state without concepts. And if we really look at our ideas of enlightenment, they're concepts. It doesn't matter whether your ideas and my ideas are the same or different. They're still ideas. They're still concepts. So if we really look at it, if enlightenment is the concept-free state, and if we're holding concepts about what enlightenment is, our ideas about enlightenment are a block to enlightenment, because we're holding two concepts, which has to keep us from the concept-free state, right? How can you hold to concepts, be sure you're right about what enlightenment is, and know the concept-free state? You can't. So I'm going to go on to the next question. Number 7. What is the difference between ordinary sleep and waking sleep? Here's the answer. In ordinary sleep, there are not only no thoughts, but also no awareness. In waking sleep, there is awareness alone. That is why it is called awake while sleeping. That is the sleep in which there is awareness. So, I'm not 100% sure what they're talking about. Again, my guess is they are using, well, in fact, you know, what's in parentheses here are specific Hindu terms, you know. So I suspect, again, the conversation is still coming from a Hindu type of education where certain terms are used, and that would lead to the question. I can guess maybe what is meant by waking sleep, but I don't see any sense in guessing, especially since I might be wrong. So I'm just going to go to the next question. Only looking for what's useful here and willing to leave the rest. As far as I know, you guys aren't going to give me a test afterwards, right? So number 8. Why is the true self described, yes, this is still these same types of questions. Why is the true self described both as the fourth state and beyond the fourth state? And the word for the fourth state, because Ramana Maharshi is going to use it, the word for the fourth state is Turiya. So again, the question is, why is the true self described both as the fourth state and beyond the fourth state? And Ramana Maharshi says, Turiya means that which is the fourth. The experiencers of the three states of waking, dreaming, and deep sleep, who wander successively in these three states, are not the self. So there we know what the first three states are, I guess. Waking, meaning ignorant wakefulness, dreaming, and deep sleep. And Turiya would be beyond waking, dreaming, and deep sleep. Turiya means that which is fourth. The experiencers of the three states of waking, dreaming, and deep sleep, who wander successfully in these three states, are not the self. It is with the object of making this clear, namely, that the self is that which is different from them and which is the witness of these states, that it is called the fourth or Turiya. When this is known, the three experiencers disappear, and the idea that the self is a witness, that is the fourth, also disappears. That is why the self is described as beyond the fourth, or Turiyatita. All right, so I need to pause here. I need to comment on two authors that I have been reading since November. I might have commented on this a little bit last week. I don't remember. The first one is Bernadette Roberts. And I read her book, The Experience of No Self, and her other book, What is Self? And I remember when I was reading the book, although I mentioned to you all several times I was reading it, I also mentioned that I didn't really recommend it. I don't know if you guys remember that. And I'm now reading, I'm just about done with Floyd Henderson's first anthology for advanced seekers, and then he has a second anthology, which I will read next. And, you know, I've got just a hair left in this first anthology, and then I'll move to the second anthology. And I've decided that in the third year of Gentle Healing, we will go ahead and read that, although sometimes I have to admit I doubt my decision. But I think I'm going to stick with it. But I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why I either don't recommend these books or hesitate to recommend these books. It's because they blow all spiritual believing out of the water. You know, while we've been on this spiritual path, we've read a number of books that we thought were quite good, you know, such as A Course in Miracles and, you know, NTI and, you know, other great books. And these books point toward truth, absolutely. But what also happens when we read these books from our ignorance is we develop ideas about truth. And we also become somewhat attached to our ideas about truth, even if we're not the type that, you know, goes into the different forums and argues for our point of view. We actually do develop a point of view about truth. I don't think we can help but do that. And what happens when you read these books is they blow that out of the water. And it can be somewhat disorienting. you know, and I remember in the Course, Jesus talks about it being disorienting. And there's this thought sometimes, I'm just being honest here, there's this thought sometimes of, I can't tell people this. They'll quit the spiritual path. Like, they need their little fantasies. Of course, that's just my own projection, right? So the reason I'm bringing this up is because last week and this week when I'm reading what's happening here about the self, you know, how come the fourth stage is called the self? And then that which is beyond the fourth stage is called beyond the self. And, you know, Ramana Maharshi is saying, really, there's no difference. You know, once you hit the fourth stage, you're enlightened. And whether you go beyond that or not, it's irrelevant. I just got to say that these two books that I've read, and just... these two books are these two authors that I've read, Floyd Henderson and Bernadette Roberts. And I've mentioned this part to you. Do talk about awakening to consciousness. And they talk about awakening beyond consciousness. And that makes perfect sense to me, because prior to reading either of them, if you guys know me well, you know, back in 2012, I was contemplating quotes in the Seven Steps to Awakening. And I came across a realization within myself that there was something that couldn't really be called something, but there was something beyond consciousness. Like, I came upon the realization myself that when people awaken to consciousness, they haven't gone all the way yet. And that's when I developed what I call the Four Principles of God, just as a means of expressing what I came across. And I knew on my own that which was beyond consciousness would be entirely different than anything that, you know, we could never fathom with the mind. We could never imagine with the mind. And I also knew that which was beyond consciousness is beyond what we call subject-object consciousness. It's beyond being aware of something, a me aware of a something. And this is why we could never imagine it. Ramana Maharshi, you know, I don't know how long you guys have been listening to the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi, because I used to teach it on Wednesday. First of all, Cindy says, I've been listening to Nisargadatta lately, and he seems to blow many of my previous concepts out of the water. Yeah, and you know what? If we're genuine about this, even though, you know, part of me wants to hesitate, like, oh, no, when we go here, everybody's going to leave. Oh, no, they're all going to quit spirituality. If we're genuine about this, right, what we're really seeking is truth, not fantasy. Do you guys agree with that? And so if we're really seeking truth, well, then we need to keep that in mind as our fantasies start to get blown out of the water. Right? We really need to keep that in mind. But what I was about to say was, I don't know how many of you all have been with me since I've been reading through the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi, because I used to do it on Wednesdays and now I'm on Sundays, and it's a different audience. You know, on Wednesdays I had like, three regular people who showed up, three or four people, and now there's, 27 in the room. So it's kind of like joining right in the middle unless you were listening to the audios. You know, it's a big difference. But Ramana Maharshi refers to that state beyond consciousness as concept free. Because in consciousness, there really is still a concept. There's still the I am concept, the I exist concept. And so he refers to the awakening that is beyond consciousness as concept free. And so I need to bring that up because here when he's talking about it, the fourth stage, you hit concept free. And so it really doesn't matter what's beyond the fourth stage. He's referring to the first principle of God. He's referring to the awareness that is not aware of. The awareness that just is. And beyond that, any ideas beyond that, that show up in a teaching somewhere, are merely ideas. Maybe that, I don't know, I mean, I can't say. Maybe this person's spiritual concepts just need to be blown out of the water too. You hear some teachings that talk about things like the 12 levels of heaven or whatever. All these kinds of teachings aren't true. So I think it's important for us to be aware of the fact that this is actually quite simple, although it doesn't always feel that way. That what we are literally doing is letting go of the mind, and more specifically, thoughts, ideas, concepts. And, typically what we do all the time is that we are thinking. We're in a world of concepts. We're thinking. And when we're reading, we're acquiring more concepts. And then we're trying to make everything fit into nice, neat little conceptual boxes. And again, if enlightenment is a concept-free mind, which just blows everything out of the water, and whatever enlightenment is a realm or a way of being that we can't even imagine right now, it's kind of a waste of time to spend a lot of time trying to understand spiritual concepts. So questions like, well, how come the self is described as the fourth state and beyond the fourth state? Can you see how that's just a mind trying to understand? That's just a mind trying to gain concepts, trying to have a mental framework. This morning when Jay was talking, he talked about spiritual practice as preparing the ground. Spiritual learning to some degree does that too. you know, there's some understanding that when the understanding occurs, that enables us to begin the process of questioning and letting go, that enables us to sit and close our eyes in meditation and focus on awareness. You know, there's a certain amount of learning that occurs where we get enough understanding that then we're motivated to those true practices, inquiry and letting go and meditation. But to spend time trying to understand truth with the mind, well, we could call it, if we wanted to, we could call it moving in the wrong direction. You know, if you look at the Tao Te Ching talks about how, and I don't remember the exact words, but how, you know, the person in the world tries to gain information, right? And the Taoist master is leading people to let go of information, to let go of learning, to let go of concepts. Because enlightenment is concept free. So again, I'm going to continue going through these questions to see if there's anything useful here, but, you know, trying to understand truth, trying to make it fit into certain mental boxes, is a waste of time. And if we do that, which we've all done that, at some point, every single idea that we adopted is going to have to be blown out of the water. Every one of them. There's not one remaining. So question number 9. What is the benefit derived by the sage from the sacred books? Here's Ramana Maharshi's answer. The sage, who is the embodiment of the truths mentioned in the scriptures, has no use for them. Right? No use for them. Number 10. Is there any connection between the attainment of... Oh, we've already answered this question ourselves. Here we go. Is there any connection between the attainment of supernatural powers and liberation? And remember, I spoke a moment ago and said there's no connection between, you know, you can't expect enlightenment to look a certain way. That idea that you're not enlightened unless you can raise the dead and heal the sick is not true. Sometimes people can raise the dead and heal the sick and they're not enlightened. And other times, you know, someone is fully enlightened and they can't raise dead or heal sick people, right? Like, there's just not really a connection there. Let's see if Ramana Maharshi says the same thing. Here's the question. Is there any connection between the attainment of supernatural powers and liberation? Ramana Maharshi says, enlightened inquiry alone leads to liberation. Supernatural powers are all illusory appearances created by the power of Maya. Self-realization, which is permanent, is the only true accomplishment. Accomplishments which appear and disappear, being the effect of Maya, cannot be real. They are accomplished with the object of enjoying fame, pleasures, etc. They come unsought to some persons through their karma. Know that union with Brahman is the real aim of all accomplishments. This is also the state of liberation known as union. So there we go. Ramana Maharshi does say the same thing. You know, that raising the dead, healing the sick, manifesting apples out of thin air, you know, whatever, manifesting golden rings out of midair. I think that's something that one teacher used to do. All of these things are meaningless. Now, he doesn't say that it doesn't sometimes happen. He does say that some people acquire these skills because they're seeking fame or power, but he also says it does come to some people unsought. You know, so this really puts us in a predicament as far as the mind goes, because the mind wants a nice, neat rule that it can trust. So, you know, an example of a nice, neat rule would be either enlightened people can heal the sick and raise the dead, or enlightened people don't bother with healing the sick and raising the dead. Then we have a nice, neat rule either way. But when he answers in the way he does, and he says sometimes these powers come unsought, what this really means is sometimes there are going to be enlightened people who cannot and do not heal the sick and raise the dead, and sometimes there are going to be enlightened people that do. Because it's just, as he says, a part of their karma. It comes along with that body, right? So again, this brings us back to needing to let go of all of our beliefs and ideas about enlightenment. It leaves us in that same place where there's not a single idea about what enlightenment is, or what an enlightened person should look like, or how they should act, or what their experience should be, that we can rely on, except for the no concept part. Now, that's also interesting, by the way. I'll just bring that up. There are people who claim to be awake, and I'll just tell you what I suspect. I suspect they are awake to consciousness. I don't see them as liars. I suspect they are awake to consciousness. They just haven't awakened beyond consciousness. They might not even know there's an awakening beyond consciousness, right? And what they talk about, you know, we've interviewed them right here for our satsangs, and you can hear them elsewhere. What they talk about is, oh, the mind is still here. It still chatters. I just don't believe it. Those who speak of enlightenment beyond consciousness speak of a quiet mind, concept-free. The speaking just happens. The doing just happens. The thinking is no longer there. So that means that if our mind is still chattering, even if we don't listen to it to a large degree, we have clearly not yet reached a state of mind that is called concept-free. And by the way, the concept-free mind is also called no mind, because mind and thoughts are considered synonymous. So no thoughts is also no mind. So again, Ramana Maharshi says, the question was, is there any connection between the attainment of supernatural powers and liberation? And Ramana Maharshi says, enlightened inquiry alone leads to liberation. Well, what is enlightened inquiry? Well, really, enlightened inquiry is seeking to know the true self, but sometimes by questioning the thoughts in order to see through them, in order to let go of them, in order to see they have no meaning, no value. There's a difference between what he's calling enlightened inquiry and the type of questioning that the questioner is doing, where the questioner is inquiring, clearly asking questions is inquiring. But the questioner is inquiring for the purpose of obtaining a mental understanding of truth and making everything fit into nice, neat mental categories. That is not enlightened inquiry. In fact, recently in Gentle Healing, and if you're reading NTI, we were given a list of ways that the mind resists truth. Was that today? And one of the ways that the mind resists truth is by asking questions, trying to understand truth. That's a resistance to truth. So asking questions, trying to understand truth, and we all go through this phase. You know, I'm not saying that we're guilty for it, but we're ready to see that that's resistance to truth. Trying to mentally understand truth is resistance. Trying to acquire an understanding of truth is a resistance because it's acquiring concepts rather than letting go of concepts. So enlightened inquiry is the type of inquiry that we practice that leads us to letting go of concepts. Seeing that they're meaningless, seeing we have no use for them anymore, and letting go, emptying the mind of thoughts. And of course, it's enlightened inquiry to be seeking to notice the true self, awareness, rather than having attention on the mind. That's also a type of enlightened inquiry, right? In Inner Ramana, that's called little s self-inquiry and capital S self-inquiry. Yeah, Jay is listing another resistance, things I must do to be seen as worthy. Yeah, you know, there was a time when one of the things I would have needed to do in order to seem worthy would be to understand all of this material I'm teaching before I teach. And now I'm just like, you know, I don't care about this. Let's not pay attention to that. I'm not worried about being worthy. I'm not worried about being judged, whether I am or am not. I'm focused on what matters and what doesn't matter. That's different than wanting to be worthy, right? Wanting to appear like I know something. So again, is there any connection between the attainment of supernatural powers and liberation? Enlightened inquiry alone leads to liberation. Supernatural powers are all illusory appearances created by the power of Maya. Self-realization, which is permanent, is the only true accomplishment. Accomplishments which appear and disappear, being the effect of Maya, cannot be real. They are accomplished with the object of enjoying fame, pleasures, etc. And I would say in India, this is especially true, which is where he is at. You know, although lots of people think something of spiritual accomplishments, you know, lots of people in lots of different countries, almost India especially. Like in India, it's a really big deal to have special powers, right? And so in India, they have a lot of people who have not attained any enlightenment at all, but have attained special powers. And in fact, a really great book that you can read is Paul Brunyan. Is that his name? Let me find the book. If I can. It's called A Search in Secret India. I can't find it real quick. A Search in Secret India is the name of the book. And it's a really good book. Yeah, because he has superb discernment. And he's able to discern between those people that have these incredible special powers but have no enlightenment and those who do have some enlightenment. And in fact, the teacher he ends up settling on is Ramana Maharshi at the end of the book. But it's a great book because you can really see his discernment as you're reading the book, A Search in Secret India. So again, in India especially, there are people who are able to obtain, you know, very special powers that seem to defy the laws of the world, But they have no enlightenment whatsoever. And in fact, as Ramana Maharshi says, the real reason they're doing it is for fame, for pleasure. They want attention. They want, you know, people to think they're special, right? So the fact that someone can do these things doesn't mean that there's any enlightenment present at all. He also says that these special powers come unsought to some persons through their karma. So, you know, assuming our stories about Jesus in the Bible are true, Jesus may be an example of someone who was not seeking the power to heal or seeking the power to raise people from the dead. He was seeking truth, seeking enlightenment, but these powers came to him unsought. And, you know, that is a possibility because if you read the Bible, Jesus often tells people after he heals them, don't tell anybody, right? Don't tell anybody. But, of course, they run off and tell people anyway. Know that union with Brahman is the real aim of all accomplishments. This is also the state of liberation known as union. All right, so let's go on to the next question. Question number 11. If this is the nature of liberation, why do some scriptures connect it with the body and say that the individual soul can attain liberation only when it does not leave the body? Again, can you guys hear how this person is trying to create a mental understanding of truth? Make everything make sense mentally? Do you hear that? It's not necessary. It's an obstacle. We'll keep reading, but you know, it's really important to see that the mental gymnastics this person is going through, sitting there with Ramana Maharshi, can you imagine? With Ramana Maharshi and still trying to mentally understand everything. You know, it's funny because Michael Langford, when people, there was a time, it has stopped now, but there was a time after I went and met Michael Langford out at his house, that people would email me questions and ask me to email them to Michael. And at first I did, you know, the first few, just to be nice, I forwarded them on, until Michael made it clear that he doesn't answer these questions because the questions are just resistance. They're just ego. And so I quit forwarding the questions to him, and I just let people know, you know, when they would write to me that Michael doesn't answer questions, and eventually, you know, it all settled down and it stopped. For a while there, I felt kind of like his secretary. you know, there was a time earlier in my spiritual path, in my perception, I would have judged Michael as rude. You know, I would have said, these are sincere seekers who are trying to understand the truth and you won't even answer their questions. You're rude. I didn't have that judgment of Michael, but at an earlier time I would have. But now I see that he just has the discernment to know that this person, in fact, he would say they're not ready. He would say that as well. They weren't ready for the genuine spiritual path, which is the practice of enlightened inquiry and awareness, watching awareness, meditation. They were still in the mind, wanting to understand everything with the mind, and he just wouldn't get involved in it. He said they're not ready. So you can hear this in the question. If this is the nature of liberation, meaning this state that has nothing to do with special powers, because that was the last question, right? If this is the nature of liberation, why do some scriptures connect it with the body and say that the individual soul can attain liberation only when it does not leave the body? Ramana Maharshi says, it is only if bondage is real that liberation and the nature of its experiences have to be considered. So far as the self is concerned, it has really no bondage in any of the four states. And we're going to have to go back to this next week because I'm running out of time. So I'm going to stop here and comment on what he's saying. In a way, some people could perceive him as contradicting something he said just a little bit ago. Because just a little bit ago, he said the reason we say that the fourth stage is the self is to make it clear that the first three stages, the person who experiences waking up in the morning, falling asleep at night, and dreaming at night, that person is not the self. You know, we need to distinguish. Here's not self, and then self starts here, right? Well, now he is saying that there is no bondage at all. That the self is never in bondage. So is this a contradiction of what he said earlier? And the answer is no. Because any one of us right now who, you know, I don't really think of myself as in bondage, but using these terms, any one of us who is in bondage, we're not to the concept free state yet, we can go into awareness watching awareness meditation and we can see that the awareness is already beyond concepts, even if we're still locked in the concept state. So we can see for ourselves that there is a difference between mind and awareness. And we can see that awareness, however, even right now, while we may still be very attached to the mind, right now, awareness is concept free. You can see that yourself. So the purpose of separating out and saying the self doesn't appear until the fourth stage, that's really just a teaching tool. Right? It's just a teaching tool. In truth, the self is always present, and the self is always concept free. It's kind of like Jesus said in the Course, something about how, you know, you and I are the same. The only difference is, he uses love to describe that concept-free awareness state. The only difference is that with me, there's just love. There's nothing else. With you, there's that same love that I am, but then there's all this other stuff too. Right? So it's the deaccumulation. It's the letting go of everything that's in the way of the concept-free awareness that's already here. That's what we need to be working on. And with that, I'm out of time, so I need to let go of the mic. And we'll continue, we'll look at the same question again next week. Goodbye, everyone.